As much of Europe is just inundated with tourist crowds lately, the southeast corner, that's a region called the Balkans, offers travelers good off-the-beaten-path options. While the region does have some places that are popular with tourists, most of it just doesn't register with Americans. But the region is starting to be better appreciated for its rustic charms, its lack of crowds, good prices, and as a great destination for travelers who've yet to venture out of Western Europe. My friend and fellow guidebook author Cameron Hewitt joins us now with a report from his recent trip to the untouristed corners of the Balkans in basically former Yugoslavia. Cameron, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Boy, oh boy, you're carving out new frontiers for Americans to travel in, and the Balkans are really something. Now, let's get some context. It was basically former Yugoslavia and a little bit more, right?
Yeah, the western half of the Balkans was Yugoslavia, the eastern half, Bulgaria and Romania. It's basically the southeastern peninsula of Europe between the Adriatic Sea on one side, the Black Sea on the other, going from basically Hungary in the north to Greece in the south.
Now, we say Yugoslavia because you and I are old guys. Some people might not even hardly remember Yugoslavia.
It was quite a while ago, but
was Yugoslavia?
Well, so right now there are seven countries that used to be one big country, Yugoslavia, which lasted through the early 1990s when, of course, there were all these wars between various factions there. But, you know, even today, a lot of people in many of these countries are still sort of nostalgic for they talk about ex-Yugo. It's sort of the shorthand.
Yeah. Well, we also know the word Balkan as kind of a political term for a place that's just rough and tumble or arguing all the time, or what is that term?
Yeah, it's kind of tragic, especially in the 1990s during these wars. That name sort of became synonymous with interethnic strife.
Because Balkanization is a thing when things fall apart.
Yes, and things in the Balkans are very complicated when you dig into the history, both recent and old. Of course, you might know World War I started in the Balkans with the assassination of the Austrian Archduke in Sarajevo. There are a lot of kind of longstanding grudges. At the same time, there's a lot that unites the people of the Balkans. And I think these days, I feel like people are starting to reclaim Balkans not as a term of derision, but a term of pride. And I think there's a lot of Balkan pride going on.
Well, there's quite a bit of bad baggage. If you happen to be a tourist destination wanting more people to come, hey, come on over here. It's the land of Balkanization.
It's a tough sell. Lonely Planet had a book, I think they still do, that they call the Western Balkans, which is the area we're talking about. Boy, that's a tough term to market, right? And they are some of the most beautiful and interesting destinations in Europe, but they've got kind of a branding problem, I would say.
So, Cameron, in my introduction, I mentioned that there are a few well-touristed corners of the Balkans. So to start out, what part of the Balkans are already popular with tourists?
Well, first and foremost, Croatia. Croatia is hugely popular, and it constitutes the majority of the Balkan coastline in a lot of ways. So if you've been somewhere in the Balkans, it's probably Croatia.
The Dalmatian coast, Dubrovnik and so on.
All that stuff, yeah. And then Slovenia up in the north is also becoming a little more known. Both of those countries are in the European Union. You know, they have the Euro and open borders and so forth. So they're very accessible, and I would say those are the hot destinations in the Balkans.
And you wrote in your blog about certain places are touristed, but not with Americans.
Yeah, when you get to kind of away from those very touristy places and into the heart of the Balkans, places like Bosnia and Serbia, Macedonia and Montenegro and so forth, I was often the only American that I was aware of. But that doesn't mean they're not touristed. You have a lot of people from other parts of the Balkans or from Eastern and Central Europe. And then in Sarajevo in particular, and in Bosnia, there's a strong Muslim heritage. And you get tourists from the Muslim world.
Because, you know, they say this is the most Western minaret on a mosque or something like that. I mean, this was sort of an outpost of Muslim civilization centuries past in former Yugoslavia.
Yeah, the Ottoman Empire occupied most of what we now think of as the Balkans. And so they left behind a lot of that heritage. And in Bosnia in particular, it's become a very attractive destination for people from the Muslim world who want to kind of get a look at Europe, but they want to go to a part of Europe that is culturally more familiar to them.
Cameron Hewitt is my senior content manager at Rick Steves Europe. He co-authors the Rick Steves Guide for Central Europe and for Croatia and Slovenia, Budapest, Greece, and even Iceland. He features his favorite travel blogs and photos at CameronHewitt.com. Right now, we're hearing about Cameron's latest discoveries from recent travels in the countries of the Balkan Peninsula. I'm so fascinated by your recent adventure. I mean, you took a break from researching the many Rick Steves guidebooks where you're such a valued contributor, and you went on vacation to places that we don't even mention in Europe. Say some of the names of places you'd went to, just so we can hear the names, because these are household words in those places, but they're new to me.
Yeah, I wanted to do a road trip and just connect some dots I'd never been to or hadn't been to in a while. Places like Sarajevo, Belgrade, Podgorica, the capital of Montenegro. Kosovo, of course, the capital there, Pristina. Prizren is another beautiful town in Kosovo. North Macedonia, Skopje, the capital there. Lake Ohrid, also in Macedonia. And then while I was there, I went into Albania also. So I went to the capital, Tirana, went to Gjirokastër and Berat, which are a couple of beautiful kind of hill towns. Really had a wonderful time in all these places.
I don't know how you could probably spell them too with the right...
with all the right diacritics. Yeah, I probably could.
Hey, another thing that adds the confusion to me is, you might have known it if you're an old timer having traveled there in Yugoslavian days by a different name. Titograd.
Yes. So Titograd was originally Titograd. Now it's Podgorica as the capital of Montenegro. It was turned into a big capital during the early post-war years and took the name of the Yugoslav leader Tito. And now it's back to Podgorica.
So once upon a time, there was Leningrad, Stalingrad, Titograd, and now they're all different.
And now they've all often reverted to a traditional name or something. Yeah.
I would just like, before we delve into some of these places, let's talk about just general what we call nitty-gritty for travelers in the region. You know, red tape, visas, money changing, language barrier. What's the basics?
So I would say traveling in these places is really not that much more complicated than other parts of Europe. There's no visas required for Americans to go to any of these places. English is widely spoken. I didn't have any trouble. I don't speak these languages. I had no trouble getting around. I would say the most complicated thing is connecting the dots if you're doing a multi-country tour, because each country is very much its own sort of entity, and it's hard to get a bus across a border or a train across a border. And so the biggest challenge I had was just making the itinerary, figuring out how to connect a few key dots to be efficient. And I did a variety of trains, which can work well, and buses, and then I rented a car for part of it as well.
This is Travel with Rick Steves, and we are uncovering lesser-known destinations in the Balkans right now with guidebook author Cameron Hewitt. Cameron spends about a third of the year researching and updating guidebooks, and he's written a book called The Temporary European: Lessons and Confessions from a Professional Traveler. Cameron's website is cameronhewitt.com, H-E-W-I-T-T. So, Cameron, let's talk about a few of the places you went to. Not anything famous, not Dubrovnik, not Sarajevo even, but places that you didn't see any other Americans. What's your takeaway?
Well, in particular, for example, I was really taken with Kosovo, which I didn't expect to like as much as I did. It was, frankly, a box-ticking exercise. Like, well, I should go to Kosovo while I'm there. And I just was so charmed by it, and I think it kind of embodied what I loved about the whole region. Really interesting, complicated history and heritage. This is a place that's shared between Serbs and Albanians, who are mostly Muslims. And yet, I had a lot of wonderful individual interactions, both going to important historical sites and talking to people. And I came away with a much greater understanding of this place that we might remember from news headlines. And now I understand it on a more intimate kind of
Kosovo,
personal level.
That's a small country kind of, I see it as kind of slapped onto Albania on the north and the west side. That is a lot of Albanian culture and heritage, but it wasn't in the Albania that we remember being the most isolated country in the world. So you could get a taste of Albania by going to Kosovo.
Yes, and why it's complicated is it was historically the homeland of the Serbs, a totally different group. And it's mostly Albanian now, but there are still important Serb cultural artifacts there. And so therefore, the Serbs don't recognize Kosovo even as a different country. But yes, that's why it's fascinating. I love these places that are complicated because you really come away with a deeper understanding of all of these. If you go with an open mind and kind of ask questions, you come away with a broader understanding of a place that became just sort of headline fodder. You know, Kosovo is literally where the Yugoslav War started in the 1990s. It's also where they ended in the early 2000s. So it's a hugely important location. And even as someone who loves this region, I had never been there. And it was just fascinating and wonderful to be able to get to know it.
You know, if I think back in the communist times, every big city had its obvious little vacation destination nearby. And in Poland, it was Zakopane, I think, up in the mountains. Budapest, it was the big lake.
Balaton.
Everybody went to Lake Balaton. And in Serbia, for Belgrade, it feels like people go to Lake Ohrid.
Yeah. Well, Serbia, really for the whole region, but Lake Ohrid it's on the border between North Macedonia and Albania, but it's close to Kosovo and it's close to a lot of these places. And that was another really beautiful place. One thing I haven't mentioned maybe enough is this region has incredible natural beauty. It's very mountainous. It's very rugged. Lots of lakes and mountains and beautiful rivers and so forth. And Lake Ohrid, which is sort of tucked in the mountains in the middle of this region, is a very beautiful, historic, and a popular resort. But again, it's very popular with people from the Balkans, people maybe from Eastern and Central Europe. And as an American, I felt like it's busy, but where are all the Americans, you know?
Okay, so we're kind of dancing around the borders of Albania. And I know you're very enthusiastic about Albania. It's kind of almost another topic for an interview, but what was your take on Albania?
Yeah, Albania is, it's really hot right now. It kind of has been picked up, especially in European media, because it's a great budget beach destination. It has beautiful beaches, and it's very affordable. And I just wanted to take a look at it. I was at the capital and some of the hill towns. I also went to the beaches. My takeaway is I really liked Albania. There was a lot to like. I found the people very charming, sort of disarmingly welcoming, and it was fun to learn about. The beaches are kind of an interesting case. They are some very beautiful beaches. But, you know, it's a fledgling destination. And one thing that happened that I thought was really interesting, everyone in Albania was telling me this, they had a big year last year and they got a lot of press. And so they raised all the prices because they'd gotten all this attention. And then suddenly no one wanted to come to Albania because this was a place where people from Britain or Germany were going for a budget beach vacation. And now suddenly it was the same price as, you know, Greece or Croatia. And it's like, well, no, we were going partly because it was cheap and it's not cheap anymore. So it's been interesting to see they're figuring out you have to kind of be competitively priced and figure out what your niche is. I think Albania's niche is sort of an affordable beach or mountain town break. And if they try to raise the prices too fast, it's not going to behoove them probably.
What about safety? You know, because when you travel around Europe, you hear a lot of people cursing Romanians and Albanians for stealing their cars and this kind of thing. You're right there in that territory.
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of, especially in other parts of Europe, stereotypes about this. I got to say, I felt very safe. And I'm, you know, of course, I'm a guy who looks like he could probably handle himself. So maybe others would have a different experience. But I felt very, very safe. And I've heard it said by other travelers of various backgrounds, they feel as safe in the Balkans as they do in anywhere in Europe. In fact, safer than they do in a lot of big Western European cities. You know, as with anywhere, you have to be mindful of pickpockets. I was a little nervous about having a rental car going into Albania, and because that's sort of the stereotype, Albanians steal rental cars. So there was a joke once to Europeans in Germany, for example, come to Albania, your car is already here, was sort of the old stereotype. So I asked around about this, and a lot of local people and people in neighboring countries said, yeah, that was a stereotype. There might be a little bit of that, but you're not going to be in any danger of necessarily having your car stolen. And I was fine. I felt very safe in terms of personal safety and theft and so forth.
I would imagine you invested in local guides as you traveled. We're both big fans of the value of spending a little money and hiring a local to be your sidekick as you're in one of these places that there's probably not a lot of great travel information in print available. What was your experience with guides?
Yeah, that was my priority. I wanted to spend time with a person from each place. And I had mostly an outstanding experience. Now, I pretty carefully vetted the guides. I asked for recommendations from people I knew, and I got excellent value for it. I would say in a place like this, it's very affordable to hire a guide. It's less expensive, and the value they add to your trip is greater than in places where it could be more expensive.
I love that. What's the cost for a guide for half a day, just roughly?
Oh, I spent, it could have been 50 or 100 euros for a half day.
So 100 bucks for a guide for half a day. I mean, I cannot think of a better value, period, in that part of Europe.
And I like the guiding and learning about the history and the facts and figures. But more than that, I like talking to a person from that culture.
Yeah,
you've
got your friend.
Yeah, what's it like to be living in North Macedonia? What's it like to be from Kosovo?
I always joke, when you look at my TV shows, I've always got my friend and fellow tour guide with me. And I said, it seems like I've got friends everywhere in Europe. And then I say, I'm just paying them to be my friends. For 100 bucks, you've got a friend. And they want to do a good job. I think that's really important. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Cameron Hewitt. And I've worked with Cameron for a long time, and he has always been enthusiastic about what we call Central Europe now. Not Eastern Europe anymore, but Central Europe. And Cameron's written a book called The Temporary European, Lessons and Confessions from a Professional Traveler. And he's fresh back from a trip to the corners of Central Europe, the Balkans. And that's what we're talking about now. Hey, Cameron, when you went to the Balkans, I wonder if there's leftovers from the last generation's war. I mean, when I stand on the ramparts of Dubrovnik and I look over the city, you see the dark red and the bright red tiles on the roofs. And your local friend will say, well, the bright red tiles are the buildings that were bombed out and rebuilt in the last generation. Did you have any sense that there was a terrible war here just in grandpa's memory?
I would say you don't see a lot of actual signs of damage from the wars. It's the infrastructure and everything's been cleaned up. Of course, people have very long memories and very strong feelings about this, and it's different in different places. That can be a really interesting component to traveling here, is hearing firsthand from people who lived through this. My sense was, for the most part, these societies are trying to move on and kind of get beyond some of that old baggage. But there are certainly people in each place who really cling to it. And in certain countries, there's definitely been a flare-up of trying to reignite passions about something from the 90s for political gain. And there's some concern in a few places that that could destabilize things.
So there's that things. Simmering, angry sort of nationalism.
Nationalism, yeah. That and I think that will always be there. A couple of friends in this region have said, I think it could take, if maybe we had one or two generations without any war, it would help put this behind us. But it takes a very long time to recover from some of these things. Often it flares up like at soccer matches, which is kind of interesting. A lot of this stuff comes to a head when people are rooting on their soccer team, especially between two groups who have sort of bad blood between them.
Does it kind of boil down to religious heritages, Muslim, Orthodox, Catholic?
This region has a tremendous, well, part of what I love about it is this region has a tremendous amount of diversity. So yeah, you have large groups of Roman Catholics and also Eastern Orthodox and also Muslims. You know, it's sort of like Northern Ireland, where it's a little bit less about the faith. These are not like religious battles. It's about the political influence that each group has. The groups are defined by their faith, but it's not a religious war in a sense in the 1990s. It was more about who should politically control this area or that area.
I got to say it's almost that way now in the United States.
Well, I will say I have friends in the Balkans who have the last couple of years reached out a couple of times and said, this is making me a little uncomfortable, because they remember when Yugoslavia broke up in the 1990s. And there are ways that people are positioning themselves that are starting to feel kind of...
We're getting Balkanized.
And I think that's the thing. And I there's absolutely a heritage of that in this region, but it's not unique to this region. And
But on a bigger political perspective, does the region tend to want to look west or east? Because I would imagine a lot of people would be enamored with Russia.
In most of the region, and this is very broad strokes because each country is different, generally they're looking to the west. You know, Slovenia and Croatia are in the EU. When I was in Macedonia, North Macedonia, and also in Montenegro, they were very proud to tell me they had just joined NATO in the last few years. Mm-hmm. That felt like a very important step for them in terms of being integrated with the Western, quote unquote, Western world. The one place that is really looking to the east more is Serbia. They have historically strong ties to Russia. And so even to this day, of all of these countries, Serbia is definitely the most Russia-friendly.
Cameron, we've got a couple of minutes left. Let's talk about a few of the places on your most recent trip where you mentioned there may have been some tourists, but you didn't meet a single American. How were Americans received when you did walk down a street? Did they know you're an American? Did you get any sense of you were the spectacle?
You know, it was interesting. I thought maybe I would get a little bit of that. But actually, everyone in these places just sort of took it in stride. I kind of feel like these people have sort of seen it all. Their history has been complicated. They've had a lot of people passing through. Although I did feel very welcome. I would say this region really specializes in hospitality. They really do a good job of welcoming visitors.
Is that something to do with this Muslim idea that a visitor from far away is a gift from God?
I think for sure. That's what I've always interpreted. And, you know, even though in many cases, the Ottoman heritage is not something they actively embrace, I think there are these threads from that occupation that have persisted in a lot of these cultures.
It's a nice sentiment. Cameron, thank you so much for being our bushwhacker, heading off into territory that most Americans don't even consider for their itinerary. There's a lot to learn, a lot to... And I would think we're going to see more and more people going to this corner of Europe. And thank goodness Balkanization now is not a way you would describe the region called the Balkans in Europe.
It's a beautiful place. And as other parts of Europe become very crowded and very expensive, we haven't mentioned these are also very affordable destinations. I think the Balkans are really in a prime position to sort of become more and more discovered.
All right, Cameron, we'll check back later and see how it's going. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kaz Murrah-Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. And we'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.